everybody. Welcome back to the Gray Malkin Lane podcast, where queer friends and allies gather to review and discuss the original X-Men comics in continuity order. We're putting this episode out at the beginning of March 2025, and we are going to be talking a lot about the incredible character John Proudstar Thunderbird this month. I'm so thrilled to be welcoming the real-life John Proudstar to the show, as well as the phenomenal and talented artist Jim Terry. Let me have you both introduce yourselves to our listeners, if you will. Tell us a little about yourselves, use your pronouns, and I would love to, as we begin, have you share some of your preliminary ideas on who are some of your favorite Native American superheroes are.
Glad to be here, and I am John Proudstar, he, him. I'm Basco Yaqui. I'm also Jewish and Mexican. I'm the creator of Tribal Force, which is the first all-Native superhero comic book in the history of the United States. First issue came out back in 1996. Some of you may recognize me from the television series Reservation Dogs, where I played the father of Willie Jack. I'm a proud dad and a proud grandfather.
Who are some of your favorite Native American superheroes, John?
That goes without saying. I mean, obviously, Thunderbird. Thunderbird's had such a huge effect on me as a child, and I was so excited to see him in the book. I was like, oh, you know, I just started to imagine the future and the stories that were going to happen with this guy. And then a couple issues later, Marvel killed him off, and I was so mad. I was like, I think I was 8 or 9 years old, and I was just mad at them for killing him off. The other heroes I only could look up to were Tonto from the Lone Ranger and Tonto, and Conan the Barbarian, because he kind of looked like us, you know. He looked Native, you know. He had dark skin and long hair, you know. As a kid, that was pretty much it, you know. In the hero genre, they didn't really have a lot of Native heroes in the 70s that were featured or, you know, anything like that.
Let me also welcome the wonderful Jim Terry.
My name is Jim Terry. I'm a comic book author and illustrator. Ho-Chunk from Wisconsin. I live in Chicago. Been an urban Native for some 30 years. My dad was Irish. I've been working in comics professionally for about over 15 years now. I was too young to catch John Proudstar the first time, so mine was more Danny from the New Mutants. That was my era in the mid-80s. That was really the only Native character that I was aware of, other than Forge. I didn't trust the characters the way that I wanted to, because I don't know, it's just a different thing when you know that it's not a Native who's writing it. And so I didn't trust it the same way. I thought it had cool moments, but you know, it always has that little disconnect where you have to disassociate a little bit so you can buy what they're selling.
Absolutely. Let me also welcome the wonderful Wayodi Old Bear to the show.
Thank you for having me. My name is Wayodi Old Bear. I'm a citizen of the Comanche Nation. I'm originally from Oklahoma, but I've been living in Albuquerque for a while. Being a kid in the 70s, it was thin on the ground. It was hard. What was funny is I found out when I was a little kid, one of my favorite shows was written by a Native guy, and that was the main character was Egyptian, because it was Almighty Isis. That was Russell Bates, who's a Kiowa, wrote that. That was the closest I had to Native representation in anything. When I was a little girl, we would all get embarrassed when the Super Friends came on and the Apache Chief. We'd all get ashamed, and one kid would go, "That's your relative. No, that's your relative. That's your uncle. No, that's your uncle." Forge is really good, you know, but that was like after that really delicate period when you're a little kid and you want something so bad do you know what I mean? To really relate to.
Lastly, I'm Chad Anderson. I use he, him pronouns. I got my master's in social work many years ago, and right out of school, 2 years into my career, I was hired by the Coeur d'Alene tribe in Northern Idaho. And I spent 4 years as a mental health and substance abuse counselor, and it changed my entire perspective, my career, my life, and my way of learning how to approach diversity. Just beautiful, incredible people, and the mix of modern culture with Native culture and learning the families and the traditions and the histories was just profoundly altering for me. So I'm going to be the white guy with a podcast who opens up saying, like, here I am trying to ally myself. But as we're looking at talking about a character like Thunderbird, I think it's really crucial to have the right types of voices involved in these discussions. One of the places I want to open with very quickly, my show's spending time in the mid-1970s. And when we're looking at the way storytelling was changing, and we're analyzing that in comics after man's been to the moon, and it's the Cold War, and it's post-Vietnam, and there's so many different things happening from second wave feminism to kind of bohemianism. There was a lot of movements happening for Native Americans in the country at the time, including the incredible occupation of Alcatraz. There's a lot of stories in the way history was kind of changing. Music was being appreciated at different levels. And we have a template of characters who are veterans coming back from war and then kind of launching themselves into superheroes. And there's an odd mix of these. Punisher later is that character at a very big level. But Marvel has a lot of these characters, including Wolverine. Another of them is Thunderbird, a veteran who we don't get a lot of voice until they add a lot of stories later. But him being amplified in the X-Men in this way, which then became the most popular book, and of course they kill him off very abruptly, which is horrible, it really kind of seems to change the tone for a lot of Native American superheroes to follow. So we're going to be exploring a lot why this character is so special in the next several episodes of my show. I want to talk a little bit about you as artists. All three of you are incredibly prolific, talented people with really wide resumes of different types of art that you produce. I know what it's like to be a creator. I know what it's like to need to tell stories. And as we are navigating our lives, things tend to spark different versions of those stories along the way, who we are, where we're at in our life, how old we are, etc. Can you share with people a little bit about your own artistic journey? And you're welcome to share or plug whatever you'd like in your own individual work along the way here.
I write all kinds of things. I had two books come out last year, and I have novels coming out this year. I have a comic arc about a female Native superhero. She's called the Clock, and her power is the ability to teleport along the NTP, the Net Time Protocol, any electronic device. Running that, she can teleport from one device to another, from your phone to your, printer to someone else's laptop. I have an art with her, Dale DeForest drawing it, and I'm really happy with it. I think it's going to look really amazing. I started telling stories because my grandmother took me with her to record stories as a little kid. She hung out at our tribal elderly center and recorded stories on a reel-to-reel, but I knew I wasn't qualified to tell those stories, so I had my own weird stories. Old Indians are really strange, and you hear those old stories. There are some really weird stories, and I think that gave me a taste for a story that's much stranger than you generally get exposed to. I don't know. Listening to those really old people tell stories in the 70s shaped how I tell stories and shaped the kinds of stories that interest me. I like to write about Native women who are scientists, who are innovating, and I like things that are kind of scary. So all those things go together for me. And while weaving in the real issues that we deal with in our communities and in our lives. So all those things at once. My novel that came out last year, As Many Ships as Stars, is a sort of a retelling of the story of how we first stole horses that I heard as a kid. And instead of horses, it's a bunch of Comanches stealing a public-private Mars colonizing ship. And instead of colonizing Mars, they steal the ship and become a spacefaring people traveling across space in these stolen ships.
I really love this trend that I'm seeing more recently in fiction of taking some of those stories that we've heard, or even Native tradition, and putting kind of a sci-fi bend on it. Disney's done that with some of their new...
Kahori?
Yes, her new character Kahori and Kushala in the comic books as well. They've done this kind of like spirit of vengeance bend on things, which is really fun.
I was so immersed in comics as a kid. It was the cheapest form of entertainment, for me and my grandmother. Like every 2 weeks we'd go to the store and I was allowed to buy 4 comics because that would, they were a quarter a piece. So it'd be $1 worth of comics. It had such a profound effect on me as a kid. And immediately I noticed the lack of people that look like me. And it would just force my imagination to think like, oh, well, what would Batman be like if he were Native or Latino? What would the effect be if they came from my culture? How would they behave differently? And that's what started it all for me, was just these daydreams of what if the heroes were from Native country or from a barrio. And then over a while, you know, I just became angry and disenfranchised with Marvel's efforts in trying to make Native heroes. It's always a patchwork. Like, they get images from different tribes and slap it into one character, and they have no idea how disrespectful it is, you know, when they're doing that to us. And I was waiting for Marvel or DC to come up with a decent Native hero, and of course it never happened. And finally I just said, you know what, damn it, I just jumped in, man. I had no idea how to make comic books. I didn't know the process, you know. I wasn't a professional writer, yada yada yada. And I just moved, and then I had to decide what the crux of Tribal Force was going to be. And you know, you listen to great writers and everyone says write what you know. So my background is I work with survivors of child molestation and violent youth offenders, and I'd done that for pretty much 34 years of my life. And I thought, well, I know that world, and I have you know, just a wealth of stories from that community. And I thought it would be a beautiful way to honor them. And after I had left that world, you always want to be involved. You get so attached to the kids. And I thought, well, this would be a great way to still keep connected if I created characters that mirrored these beautiful children that I knew. So one of my characters, Nita, the main character, she's a survivor of child molestation. And Gabriel, aka Little Bighorn, he was born with fetal alcohol effect and syndrome. So he's got a lot of issues, you know, anger issues. And he can't speak. He has to use sign language. And even though he gains these powers, and even though Nita gains these powers, they're still dealing with these social issues that normal, everyday Native kids have to deal with. I thought it would be a great way to show Native kids, because the kids who have gone through this, who are going through this, they don't feel that they're worthy to be a part of society. And I thought, well, let's make these great, cool superheroes, and then they'll have the same affliction or issues that they have. And they'll be able to say, hey, they're just like me, man. And they're these cool superheroes, but they're dealing with the stuff I have to deal with on a daily basis. So I thought that would be a fantastic foundation for Tribal Force. And then also as a teaching tool, just to start teaching people who we are as a people and how we treat our stories and our relationship with our gods. It's not what they think it is, you know. And you watch Ancient Aliens and all these other shows that have their idea, their take, their spin on our relationship with our gods, and it's not even close. And I'm like, wow, what stories are you reading? That's where everything on Tribal Force came from. And just wanting to pay back, you know, like, be a part of this really neat medium called comic books, because it just did so much for me as a child, and I feel thankful for it. I feel thankful for Stan Lee and Spider-Man and, you know, all the cool, you know, entertainment and dreams and coolness that it gave me in my life. And it's just my way of saying, A, I want to be a part of it, and B, I want to give back. And I hope that my stuff influences a kid somewhere, somehow, you know, some way, just giving it back.
And John, I have to ask, the origin of your name is...
When they killed Thunderbird, I swore I would bring him back. My plan was to buy him from Marvel, because I thought, well, if he's dead, he's kind of like a dead character, and he'll probably be sitting in a filing cabinet somewhere, and I'll just go, and once I have money somehow, I'll just offer them money for it, you know? You know, unfortunately, that didn't happen. So when I was in the military service, I went AWOL several times, and one of the times I ended up in LA with a friend of mine, and we went to a movie casting, and I was about to walk up there to give them my information, and my friend grabs me and he's like, dude, you've got like 4 warrants out for your arrest. You can't use your normal name. And I was like, oh crap. And she's like, next. And I just walked up there and I was like, John Proudstar.
I love this story so much.
Yeah. So I go back to my buddy and he's like, where did you get that name? And I go, Thunderbird. And I was 18 at the time. And he goes, you know, it'd be funny if you got stuck with this name. It wasn't like premeditated or anything. It was just kind of a knee-jerk thing. And that, but I'm so proud of that name. I'm so proud of that character and what he represented to me as a kid and to other Natives, you know, that I kept it in defiance of what they did, you know, of killing him. And I'm like, and when I met Stan Lee, I finally met Stan Lee at the Comic-Con, at San Diego Comic-Con, and I had my name badge on, and he's like, you look really good for being a dead X-Men.
I'm totally going to make you tell this story again when we do the Thunderbird panel.
Yeah.
And then, Jim, do you want to share a little of your artistic journey?
Sure. I don't have as great of an origin story as John did. That's awesome. He couldn't make that up. My mom was a big reader of comics and popular literature and took me to movies all the time. And that was really my sort of artistic education. I spent my summers in Wisconsin with my native family, and I spent my school year in the suburbs of Chicago. I was always the only native in the room. I didn't grow up with a lot of the same things that other people did. There's a lot that happens in that time, and you do struggle to find something that that represents you in some way. My girlfriend talks about this thing like, are you ugly or did you go to an all-white school? You know? And when I was growing up, like, Ricky Schroeder was the hot guy, and everybody looked like him. And I'm over here all broody and dark, and I'm like, I don't look like Ricky Schroeder. And so representation was very lacking. I cringed at a lot of the things that I clung to back then, because I look at it now and it feels unworthy of that kind of adoration. But it was there when I needed it. It was what it was. And so I always loved comics. And like John, I thought Conan was native. My mom always bought The Savage Sword of Conan. She didn't read the monthlies. So it was a black and white magazine format. And it seemed like those were a little closer to rated R. And so I would, sneak those and grew up reading those on the sly. My summers in Wisconsin shaped me in an entirely different way. And that is where I got a sort of vibe for thinking that was entirely different from what I experienced in the summer. So casual acceptance of things that can't be explained, and the casual acceptance of things that don't seem possible. That informs my work, and it certainly informs my worldview. I love being scared, and there's so much to be scared of when I was growing up. So many things in the woods, so many old stories. Those were the things that I loved, and I'm still a big horror fan. And I started doing comics professionally. I've always done my own books. I have a lost decade. Well, let's just put it that way. A lost decade where I kind of went off the leash and burned a lot of things to the ground. But when I got myself together, I concentrated on doing comics. I think 12 self-published books had nothing to do with being native. They were crime stories. There's a fantasy book. And when I started working professionally, whenever there was discussion of a native character in one of these superhero books, all my friends who were in the industry would be like, you should draw that. And I would get angry because I would feel like I was being pushed towards something just because of my blood. I wanted to be hired because I'm a good artist. So, I'm able to, I was able to hide behind my name because I got my father's name. I don't have a kick-ass Indian sounding name, so nobody knows what my deal is. And so I just did that for a long time. And it wasn't until about 2014, it's a long story, but something activated me. And I realized that I had to stop hiding. And I did my memoir, Come Home Indio. And then I just laid it all out on the line. And I was like, okay, I can't hide anymore. That's been like an incredible blessing. I hid for so long because, when you're the only native that you know most of the time, once somebody finds out you're native, the stupid questions just machine gun. And I was born with a Gibraltar sized chip on my shoulder. When somebody asks me something that I don't know the answer to and they think I'm supposed to, all of those things snowball into a rageful reaction. Why should I know everything? Why do I have to know everything? Why do you think I know everything? Why do you not know anything? And so I hid. I kept my hair short. People spoke Spanish to me all the time, or Tagalog. It didn't matter. Whatever. Somebody had brown hair, they mistook me for one of their own. Once I did that book, I couldn't hide anymore. And like I said, it's one of the best decisions I've ever made. I'm really proud of who I am now.
Thank you all so much for sharing your stories. So,
I'm sorry, by the way, my pronouns are he and him. And his.
When we look in fiction itself, even when Native characters are featured, it's often in stereotypes like the medicine man or the warrior or the tracker, etc. And when we look into comic books, there's so much of Native tradition that gets mixed into the idea of the character that has supernatural superpowers. They wear animal pelts or feathered headdresses. The character, a shaman on Alpha Flight, is literally the medicine man guy, right? Now, the X-Men has a little bit more sensitivity when it comes to that, particularly in later years, but there's still an active character named Warpath, and he's an amazing character, but that's a name choice, right? When we go back to the 70s, we get the characters Red Wolf and Thunderbird at Marvel. Both of them have some sort of connection to like a native god. They both name themselves after animals. They both carry things into combat. The character American Eagle comes a little bit later and fulfills that trope again. All three of these characters are veterans, by the way. We referenced that idea earlier.
I will say one thing, to have them be veterans is actually correct in my experience. I mean, my grandmother was a Marine in World War II. My sister was the top Marine recruit at Paris Island her year she went through. I was shocked when I met my husband and he didn't have anybody in the military in his family because it's just so common. I know in my tribe, our Veterans Association is one of the big things within the tribe, and the different war societies are a big deal. And the proportionate number of natives who are going to be veterans. That's right. That's true.
I'll agree with that in my experience. And it's historically been proven that natives have a larger percentage of enrollment in the military than any other people in this country, at least last I heard. The fact is that I know that in my nation, battle is and warrior culture is woven into the theology of what we practice. And so that does make a lot of sense to me. I have a lot of uncles and cousins that proudly served and have the wounds to prove it.
Yeah, my father fought in World War II. He was a sniper scout in the Marine Corps, and he fought in the Pacific Theater. And he was on Iwo Jima, Saipan, Tinian, and he took the Mariana Islands. He was one of three survivors. So that's the guy I grew up with. And he's always shrouded in mystery. He never really talked about the war. I kind of sort of had to find out about it through other people and accounts of what happened to him and his platoon on those islands. But yeah, no, that's really prevalent amongst us. But the thing where they get it wrong, where they've always got it wrong, is the white misinterpretation of our connection and our spirituality. They treat it more like the way you would write a paladin, you know, this discipline and all this other weird stuff. That's a very Euro thought process. And they have no concept, again, of our relationship with our gods and why we do what we do. It's through their eyes, you know, through their filters that, oh, they must do this because of this. They're honorable because of this. They don't want the same things we want because of this. And they get it wrong. You know, they have zero idea of our relationship. And we're so protective of that when we write about it, we're careful about what we write about, because there's some stuff you just don't want to expose because, you know, the white people have come into our world and taken stuff from us and bastardized it and prostituted it and just manipulated it for their own benefit. And now that we're the storytellers, it's our job, you know, we're the caretakers of those things of our tribe. We're very careful in how we release that stuff. But that's where they always get it wrong, is the misconception, the noble warrior, and, you know, that we're inhuman. They've taken the humanity out of us. So it's always, and I'll jump, you know, into Reservation Dogs. You know, Reservation Dogs is such a beautiful project for me to do because it was all about humanity.
And it's so funny. Yeah. Love Reservation Dogs.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Like, you know, and that's just it. I mean, you can live on a res and there can be guys, like really badass guys that you're terrified of, and scars across their face and everything like that. And yes, they're badasses and they're stoic and everything, but they're joking most of the time. You know, we're joking people, we're laughing and teasing each other, and, you know, humor is such a humongous part of our culture, and the white people always just took that out. You know, like the reservations are doom and gloom 24/7, and Reservation Dogs just put the humanity back in us, and that's what was the universal message to everyone around the world. That's why it became so popular, is because they connected to that human element that anybody, you know, like there's I'm sure there's people in Gaza when they had TV, they could relate to it. A friend of mine who lived in Iraq, Baghdad, during the second season of Reservation Dogs, she called me and said, they're talking about your show on our TV out here, and they're talking about how beautiful it is and that we should watch it because we have something in common with the natives of America, you know, the Iraqis. And that blew my mind, man. I'm like, holy crap, man. They're learning about us in the Middle East, in the cradle of humanity. And that was a beautiful thing, you know, and it's great. great that Sterling and Taika did this and the writers of Reservation Dogs, because that's it. That's, and you know, and it, what sucks is Hollywood's still asking, like, well, how do we do this again? How do we continue to do it? And it's like, dude, it's the blueprint is right there. You know, it's just make the characters human. It doesn't have to be the way you've always represented us, you know?
If you'll indulge me, let me toss a movie at each of you and let me hear your general thought. But a lot of our audience, my challenge for a lot of my listeners as I wear my therapist hat mixed with my show host hat is I really try to push people's understanding of things. So feel free to pass on any of these. But if I toss a movie each of your way, just tell me your general thoughts. Jim, tell me your thoughts on Last of the Mohicans.
That's complicated. My thoughts are very complicated. I love that movie. I love that movie for many reasons. I also think it's problematic. And, you know, when I saw that movie, I was in high school, and there's a shot, Magua and his dudes about to ambush this traveling, you know, group of people. And they are walking through the woods in the shadows of the trees, looking over at them. And you see the light and the shadows cross over their, like, ripped-ass bodies, and they're walking silently, and I was like, hell yeah, you know. And Daniel Day-Lewis is awesome. He's one of the best. But did I want, you know, him to be the center of the story? Not necessarily. So that is the problem that I always have with that. And, you know, James Fenimore Cooper's novel, you know, was kind of the first one to do this noble savage idea, which constructed an entirely different train track of ways to diminish us. That is in that as well.
Thank you very much. Wayodi, can I hear your thoughts on Pocahontas?
Oh, my God. Oh, just stab me in the chest. Why don't you? I can't. Can't I talk about The Last of the Mohicans?
Uh-huh.
It's so symptomatic of the whole problem of disinformation, of the mistelling of history, cartoonifying us. And I don't mean it because it's a cartoon. I mean, Kahori is much less of a cartoon, although they're both animated. And I say this as someone with a big white husband. Why do we always have to have a white love interest? Well, I mean, we know that the real John Smith was a terrible liar, and he told the exact same lie a couple of times in history. Like, he told almost the identical version of him events that he told about Pocahontas, who was a real person who had real horrible things happen to her that were not depicted in this. This is just such a pack of lies. It's such a pack of bullshit that I can't even. And then I always remember the story that at Disneyland afterwards, they had to hire a non-native woman to play that, because to play Pocahontas at Disneyland, because that's how off the stereotype is. We can't even play it at Disneyland. So, I mean, it's a nightmare. It's a nightmare.
I was expecting strong words, but if you need to take a moment to vomit into a bucket, we will wait here. I'm so sorry.
I think I can control myself there.
And then, John, will you tell us your thoughts on the film Dances with Wolves?
Oh, yeah, baby. Real quick side note on Last of the Mohicans, I was almost cast to play Magua. I couldn't do the role because he wanted me to cut my hair, and I said I can't, yada, yada, yada. Also, side note on Pocahontas, I dated the model for... that Disney used, and she was native
the model,
yeah, the model that they used for all the motion capture.
I was gonna say, I have a friend who was one of Mugwai's men.
Oh, cool.
He almost got bit by a snake several times. Anyway, oh,
wow. Did you guys know that I the stunts for that movie?
What?
I'm kidding, man. Can't even do a sideways roll.
Okay, Dances with Wolves.
Beat up Kevin Costner now.
Yeah, Dances with Wolves is what it is. It's a beautiful film. It's a great effort from Costner and all that other stuff. But as a film for natives, it's just white man's savior. You know, it's about a white guy. It's about a white guy and a white girl. And they come in, and this guy, he knows better than the natives, and he's going to share his technology with them and, you know, show how bad the whiteys are. are and turn into one of them and become native himself. And, you know, and it just diminishes our role. And it's just, and it's something that Costner continues to do. And I don't know Kevin or Mr. Costner, so I don't know his intentions. I don't know if he's a bad guy or a good guy. They don't understand the damage that they're doing like that, when the reality, the actual reality of history was not that. It was role reversal. You know, it was the natives teaching the white man how to survive in this land. It's continually what they do. They take that story where they're the ones in need, and they're like, okay, we're going to change it where the natives need us, because we really didn't need them. We were fine. We were surviving great. We had no issue. You know, we're, you know, in a cyclical relationship with Mother Earth. And then these guys show up and muck up all the works. But then when they retell all the story and everything, it's like, well, look how good we were. Look how good we were to the native people and how we helped them and yada, yada, yada. So that's, it's where it's damaging, because a little bit of disinformation with some validity to it is dangerous, as we're learning, you know, in our political environment and stuff like that with a certain sect of the country. All you got to do is give a couple of little facts and then code it with other stuff. And there, nobody listens to you after that. You know, they take it as fact that, no, that's the way it was, and so on and so forth. So again, it falls back on our people to chip away at all that disinformation and reintroduce us to the world and our stories. And, you know, and people are shocked when they find out what really happened. We're America's dirty little secret. When non-Americans find out the true story, referring back to Baghdad, that they call us the true Americans. The Americans you see today, those aren't the real Americans. The true Americans are the natives. As the outside world learns the truth of what happened, and everyone gets it, everyone sees that, and it makes more sense. You know, if you read real history, you're like, yeah, that makes way more sense than what the crap they were trying to shove down our throats in history class. So yeah, and that's what Costner didn't and doesn't understand. And all those other guys who are doing these new Westerns and stuff like that, they keep saying that, hey, we're honoring you, we're trying to give you a fair shake, you know, but, well, if you are, then let us write it, dude.
You know? We've done a lot of analysis from various lenses on this show. I grew up gay in a Mormon family, and you know, Mormons themselves have a very complex history with various Native American tribes. All of it really awful, truly. There's some really horrifying things, not only in the history and in the colonialization of the Utah kind of Rocky Mountain region, but also in the belief structure itself. I'd challenge listeners, and I think part of the value of this conversation for my listening audience is it's good to look at things from an analytical eye. It's good to look at the strength of something, the amplification of something, and still be able to see the problems with it at the same time. Because yeah, unless it's the right people telling the stories, then, you know, we have a big struggle. Character Thunderbird, again, we'll be exploring a lot more on my show this month, but he's a really interesting character. He really matters in a lot of ways. But the X-Men, as we referenced earlier, have a number of really incredibly amplified voices for Native characters. Forge and Danielle Moonstar are some of people's very favorite characters. I love Talisman from Alpha Flight. There's some characters that they have created more recently, like Echo, that are incredible when they are used in the correct way. So we're going to be analyzing just a brief kind of 5-page story from X-Men Gold, Volume 1, Part 4.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to paint their door a vibrant shade of blue. Others have the need to decorate their bathroom with fish, anchors, and other nautical items. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.
This was an anthology they put out around the 40-year anniversary of Giant Size X-Men number 1, which is the 50th anniversary of X-Men number 1. And they brought Len Wein back to write one 5-page story that is set during Giant Size. This is just 3 years before Len died. Len, of course, is the creator of most of the new cast of X-Men characters, including Thunderbird. We have a cutaway scene directly from Giant Size. It's the part where all of the new team has been assembled. We have them assembled on the staircase, so it's Sunfire, Banshee, Colossus, Storm, Nightcrawler, Thunderbird, Wolverine, all sitting in front of Professor X, lined up on the staircase. And we get a brief story from the perspective of Wolverine. The basic premise here is Wolverine's thinking, how would I kill each person in the room if I had to? Which is kind of a delightful premise, given that this character is the PTSD, you know, guy with the memory problems, who was just an operative for Weapon X for like 10 years, killing people and having his mind wiped over and over again. The artist on this story is Jorge Molina. We have Tom Orzechowski on letters. Nick Lowe is the editor on this book. Before we jump into the story, which is a pretty quick review, I would love to hear from each of you, like, your relationship to this team of X-Men.
Growing up, Wolverine was my guy. In the 80s, he was still mysterious. He still popped up when he needed to be there, and you were just left wanting more all the time. And now, of course, you know, I have Wolverine fatigue, and I'm like, oh, another Wolverine story, this guy. He was always the coolest. I grew up during the Claremont John Romita Jr. days, so I came in right at the end of John Byrne's run, and then, you know, it segued, I think, Paul Smith was drawing for a while. Yeah, he was amazing. And you got like Rogue and Wolverine going through their samurai stuff, and all that stuff was really awesome. But the meat of my stuff was the Romita Jr. days and Terry Austin inking. It was magical. Now I think probably Storm is the one that I look back on the most and be like, God, I wish they would get her right in one of these movies. You know, when she lost her powers and still took out Scott Summers for leadership of the X-Men, I was like, oh. As far as this group, you know, I think it's great. I love Len Wein. You know, he co-created Swamp Thing with Bernie Wrightson, which is like, you know, one of the holy grails for me.
All-time greats. Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah.
So that's awesome. The art is Marvel. I have to admit, I don't read superhero comics anymore very often. They all kind of look the same to me nowadays. It was a fun little story. Of course, he thinks he's gonna take everybody out lickety-split, and it's totally on character.
And Wayodi, are you an X-Men fan?
Yeah, I have to say, I was like, oh, Jim, you're basically saying, I think I might be a year or two older than you, but I think we're about right on the same wavelength. For me, when I was a kid, I had all my uncle's old comic. The first comic I chose for myself, I felt like, was the X-Men. And I, as an angry 12, 13-year-old girl, Wolverine really appealed to me. And the only female character that I kind of was okay with me was Storm. Now, looking back, I'm like, I'm so worn out on Wolverine, but Storm really deserves to be portrayed correctly, and she deserves to be gotten right.
Yeah, Storm has a book right now coming out that's phenomenal, and oh, really? the writer is a Nigerian man, Morewa Ayodele. I've had Morewa on the show a few times. It's really wonderful. She's had a really good glow up in the last few years.
Now I've got to find it. Okay.
Yeah, it's excellent. John, do you have a Wolverine voice?
Well, like, I was the target audience when Giant Size came out, and that's, you know, obviously where I was introduced to Thunderbird, and I didn't have any feelings towards Wolverine at the time. I thought it was a weird character, and I'm like, what's he gonna do, scratch you? You know, like, it didn't appeal to me until X-Men 141. When X-Men 141 came out, I was reintroduced to the book. I was probably like 12 years old, and I was fast, and I was done, dude. It baked my brain. It was like X-Men 141. Yeah, it was you know, John Byrne, Chris Claremont, Days of the Future Past. It was like LSD, or, you know, watching Star Wars for the first time, or listening to Beatles White Album. But the cool thing about it, like, I got so caught up in the X-Men, and this is in the 80s, and, you know, homophobia was huge, and, you know, people were hiding in the closet and everything like that. But I had bought this X-Men compendium, and in the compendium, they were talking about how the X-Men was really popular in the gay community. And, you know, 12 years old, I'm reading this. I'm like, why would it be popular with the gay people? And then they explain how the gay people felt the same way that the X-Men felt, that they were born this way. And now...
I'll interject very quickly. I think people of all types of diversity feel at home with the X-Men, but something interesting be about the queer community to consider. A lot of people don't realize they're queer until they are adolescent and sexual puberty starts happening. And that's when they learn that they are queer or even trans often. And X-Men, the powers don't manifest until you're in puberty. And then suddenly you have all this. So there's like a particular parallel with the queer community in a way.
No. And I thought it was brilliant because, you know, again, we were so homophobic and I had, you know, brothers and it was all about being tough and everything. And they were homophobic and, you know, we were just surrounded by it. But that was the first window into understanding the gay community where I was like, holy cow, they feel just like the X-Men. And we're doing what these a-holes are doing to the mutants in the comic book. And it made me not want to be like the a-holes in the comic book and, you know, be more accepting and understanding of the gay community at that time. And to me, that was just profound, you know, because I was a blockhead, man. I was, I had the brain the size of a gorilla. And for a simple comic book to break through, you know, my homophobia at that time at 12 years old, to me, that's like, wow, that's just so, that was so powerful for me. And I never forgot that. I never forgot how influential that was in, you know, broadening my horizons.
That stuff is there right from the beginning. If you go back to the earliest books in the Silver Age, but it's Claremont that really capitalizes on it. And then when we get into the 80s, it's not subtle at all sometimes. If you guys read God Loves Man Kills, it's like the Christian church is coming for mutants. Or there's a literal group in the 80s called The Right. It's villains with like Reaganomic smiles on their faces. They like fly overhead. It's not subtle at all sometimes. Okay, doing a quick review of this story. I love Jorge Molina's art. It's very characteristic. If you look up Jorge, I guarantee you've read a lot of his stuff. He has a particular kind of superhero style, of course, and there's some really fun action here. So we are on the staircase in Xavier's mansion. We have Wolverine's perspective. Gotta give Baldy credit. He managed to telepathically teach English to this entire freak show in less than an hour. Even I'm impressed. So that, first of all, is a wild thing for this man to do. You have to picture, I do a lot of thought about like Xavier as a telepath. 1,000 Xavier stories I want to tell. But I almost picture this like he has like a little mental database. It's like a little library catalog. And he just like selects with his little like mental mouse, like the English language file and then deposits it in each person's brain all at once. What a wild thing. It's crazy because this man has like been pushing himself all over the earth to assemble this team in the first place. Wolverine thinks, question is, have I made a mistake dumping Department H in favor of this squad of screwballs? I mean, how far can they even be trusted? So Cyclops gets introduced, and while he is trying to tell them the original X-Men disappeared and we're all going to be in danger and you're part of a new team, Wolverine is instead not listening. His ADHD is kicked in and he's looking around the room and having a quick fantasy about how he can murder each member of the team. It's kind of a fun premise, you guys. It's a short story, but it's really delightful. Jim, how would Wolverine kill Banshee?
Oh, he just slash his throat. And, also, I was going to say this earlier, like, there's no minority that gets off very easy, or even ethnicity or culture, you know, Banshee. Banshee's Irish stuff is kind of funny sometimes, you know, or in the Moira MacTaggert, you know, all that stuff is, it's in the same vein. It's just super broad strokes, you know, for so many different cultures.
There was a period of time recently in the comics where if a mutant died, they can be resurrected. And Moira turns into a crazy supervillain. And there's literally a story where she murders Banshee, who's her boyfriend, and skins him and wears his skin to get access to the X-Men's mansion. It's like taking somebody's hand to put it on. It's really gruesome. When you talk about the shifting narratives, things can get pretty dark sometimes. But here we have an image of Wolverine slashing Banshee's throat, which is already relatively gruesome. How would Wolverine kill Cyclops? It's just a stab to the eyeballs.
He was going to stab him in the eye. See, I was prepared for you to ask us what power we wanted.
Now I want to know which power would you all choose here.
Yeah, that's my question.
What power? Like, can we make up a power?
I think you have to limit it to the cast in this issue. I want Nightcrawler's power.
Ooh, that's a good one.
I like healing factor. I mean, I already kind of have one. So.
Yeah, that's what I was going to go for, the healing factor, because you can take all kinds of damage.
Yeah.
Oh, I just Charles Xavier. That's what I would always choose.
You go crazy.
I feel like you have no choice but to be a supervillain with that power. It's just... It's
oh, My kids actually said you would take Dr. Xavier's, well, we were discussing this morning, you would take Xavier's powers, but you would totally be Magneto, Mom.
In the brief history of Thunderbird in the early Claremont books, there is a little bit of Thunderbird versus Wolverine energy. Thunderbird has a little bit of a quality about him where he's like, anything Wolverine can do, I can do. He sees Wolverine as the tougher soldier in some ways. Claremont puts a couple stories in classic X-Men about this too. There's one where Wolverine jumps off a cliff into a waterfall. So Thunderbird's like, I can do it too. And Storm swoops in and like blows him away in the wind. And she's like, you have bones that will break. You can't do this. So there's an odd kind of comparison between these two characters. And there have been interviews with Claremont that talk about one of the reasons Thunderbird was killed off is because Wolverine already had a lot of the character's qualities. And he felt that two characters who were kind of angry veterans, oversimplifying, was kind of overdoing it. John, do you have any thoughts on that Wolverine and Thunderbird kind of comparison? And then do you want to tell us how Wolvie kills Thunderbird in his vision here?
When I found out that it was Len Wein who was responsible for killing Wolverine, I went looking for him at one of the cons, and I went to the Marvel booth and I was like, hey, you know, where's Len Wein? And they were just terrified of me. This is when I was young, you know, I had long hair and full of piss and vinegar. And I was like, well, you tell him I'm looking for him. And I was pissed, man. I was really pissed. And, you know, coming from a comic book creator and stuff like that, I'm like, yeah, it's redundant. They had to choose between Colossus, Wolverine, and Thunderbird. And Thunderbird was an amalgam of both, you know, Colossus and Wolverine. And I kind of understood why they choose that. And as a writer, writers don't want to write about natives because they don't know anything about natives. That takes a ton of research about the character's tribe. But yeah, Wolverine's advantage over Thunderbird's is experience and the fact that Thunderbird's temper, you know, he had such a bad temper. And, you know, Wolverine, unless he goes berserker, he was just a way more experienced warrior being, you know, sure, I think he was in his 90s at the time.
Sure, yeah. Or, you know, 212, depends on which story you're going with. In his vision, Wolverine basically just thinks, he's basically me without all the cool powers, which, rude. Yeah. He's strong, quick, agile, but he ain't got a tenth of the combat experience I have. He may come at me hard, and that's just the way he's going down. Wolverine then envisions killing Colossus with the very simple thought of, when it comes down to steel versus adamantium, it's really no contest, so it's a quick slash. And then we get this weird thing with Sunfire. Sunfire tosses atomic fire at people, but Wolverine's way of killing Sunfire in his vision is to, like, Wonder Woman bracelet his claws together and, like, reflect it back at Sunfire, who would have been immune to the fire in the first place. Like, that one didn't work, buddy.
The fact that Wolverine would think that is not entirely out of, we're in his narrative. So his hubris is what is telling the story right there. Not any touch with reality.
That's not how your claws work, buddy. Cracks me up. Wolverine then envisions, you know, Nightcrawler. He's like, I can smell the sulfur, so I'll be able to tell where he teleports. And he stabs Nightcrawler here. And then we jump back to reality because he finally turns and realizes there's one person here he could never be. It's Storm. So Wolverine starts to light a cigarette and she puts it out with a little rain cloud and he goes, that stogie cost me almost $1, sister. Which is amazing. And she says, smoking is a foul and disgusting habit that can kill you and I will not have it around me. And Wolverine's like, oh yeah, this is the one lady I could never beat. Then we close on Professor X turning to Wolverine and simply saying, Penny, for your thoughts, Wolverine? Don't you already know? I never pry into my own people's minds without permission. Notice he said my own people's minds, which means he's prying into other people's minds all the time. But also, that is not true. This man is in their brains all the time. Wolverine says, not much, just considering my options. And that's the end of our little story. What were your thoughts on this little 5-page interlude? I think it's kind of delightful.
It's interesting to always go back in time because, you know, you're like, now that we know so much more about all the characters, you know, it's kind of neat. It's nostalgic to be like, yeah, Wolverine probably would have been doing that, a little punk. And and that scene is so damn iconic now, you know, that staircase scene where they're all standing there and everything.
It's interesting. In the 90s, there's a story where the X-Men discover one of Charles' many secrets from the past. He has like a whole database called the Xavier Protocols, which are his detailed files on how to murder everybody. So this is almost Wolverine doing that, which is interesting.
Oh, it was great. It was nice and breezy. The artwork, super clean. Good storytelling in the art. Yeah, it's fun. And it takes me back to the more arrogant Wolverine, because in the 80s, he got a little more sensitive. sensitive, and or at least thought he started to seem a little more thoughtful. But
he started hanging out with a lot more teenage girls.
He did. That when I went back and, you know, read the classic X-Men stuff and read that story, you know, I was kind of taken aback at what a dick he was. And so, you know, it's cool to see Len Wein, you know, go back and just be like, yeah, this is what he would have been thinking at that time.
It's such a popular story trope to have the X-Men discover the secret, awful, evil thing that their leader did, right?
Yeah.
Xavier's become irredeemable almost at this point, like almost unusable, because on Xavier, there's like 80 things you can list that he did wrong, you know?
Oh, my final thought was about the very beginning of the story. He's saying, can I trust them? He's the one planning to kill, you know, making sure he has a plan to kill each one of them. So exactly how trustworthy are you, buddy? Which is a delicious irony. I mean, for me, I find it really like a funny, funny irony.
But also Xavier's like, just go train together, guys. This crazy guy that's planning on murdering you, I'm sure it'll be fine.
I'm sure it'll be fine. You'll learn to appreciate his charm.
Yeah, he was a psychopath.
Truly. But, you know, some of it was not his fault. I'm sympathetic, mostly. What an extraordinary honor to have this talented, incredible group of people. You guys write poems and you paint paintings and you draw beautiful things and you create superheroes and you make films and you act in roles. You all opened with the idea of, we didn't grow up seeing things represented, but you have become people who represent. And I think as people read your stories, Jim, as they read your memoir, there's so many beautiful things that all of you are doing. And I'm just so extremely grateful to have had you on the show today. So thank you for coming and sharing your voices. As we're wrapping up, please tell people where they can find you online. And is there anything you'd like to plug?
You can find my memoir online through Street Noise. I recommend bookseller.org is a great place to purchase books other than, you know, certain giant monolithic conglomerates. Also, you know, I worked on the Kahori book, the Marvel book, so that's in there. I just finished up a book for the Newbery Library in conjunction with an exhibition that they did here in Chicago. It's called Paper Cuts, and it's about my experience researching and going through their massive catalog of indigenous literature. And so that's available on my website, or Big Cartel, Jim Terry Art at Big Cartel. And I'm currently in talks about expanding that and giving it a wide release. But right now it's only available through the Newbery or through my site.
I have, let's see, As Many Ships as Stars, about the Comanches stealing a Mars ship, is available at Android from Android Press. We in March, I believe, my second book from Greasy Grass Press, The Burning Lie, which is an indigenous futurist story. The second in a series is coming out. And in May, Green Archer Press will be putting out the very first about the comic about the woman who can teleport along the NTP.
We're working on Tribal Force Issue 3 right now. You can find them online at Machine Comics, and that's comics with an X. And yeah, hopefully Issue 3 will be done soon. I'm currently in a movie available on Apple TV called Last Stop in Yuma County. Incredible film. I had so much fun doing it, and I think you guys will love it if you check it out. And I am currently shooting a movie in LA with Danny Trejo and Eric Roberts called Bus Stop. Not sure when that'll be done, but I'll let you know.
All right, everybody, thank you so much for listening. Thank you to Wayote, John, and Jim. I had such a good time today. We will see you all back here next time on the Grey Malkin Lane Show. Thank you for listening to Grey Malkin Lane. We hope you are enjoying this podcast. Grey Malkin Lane is produced and recorded in Salt Lake City, Utah, with music and editing done by my husband, Michael Bell, and promo art done by the incredible Seth Martell. Look for us on Patreon, where we are releasing weekly episodes about obscure characters and facts. It's a great way to participate with the podcast for only just a couple of dollars a month, and it helps support what we are doing here. Also, the best way you could help Grey Malkin Lane is by sharing and liking and subscribing, but also please leave us a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. We'll see you back here next time on Grey Malkin Lane.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to paint their door a vibrant shade of blue. Others have the need to decorate their bathroom with fish, anchors, and other nautical items. And because each homeowner has unique needs, Geico helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with Geico.